introduce you to Assistant Fire Chief Dave Pleasance with the City of St. Paul, who can explain the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Pleasance. You want to introduce yourself to the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Representative Lesh and committee members, for your time today. I am Dave Pleasance, Assistant Fire Chief and Director of Emergency Management for the City of St. Paul. I work for the St. Paul Fire Department.
Please proceed.
Thank you. We appreciate Representative Lesh's willingness to bring forward this important piece of legislation. It is critical not just for the City of St. Paul, but for the whole region, that there is coordination between the state and city on emergency planning. I can't emphasize enough that this planning is really in our best interest. We are vulnerable to a large-scale emergencies on a daily basis. We don't have to wait for a pandemic flu to hit. When a train is running through the city, it could have an accident and spill thousands of tons of dangerous, hazardous materials this afternoon. The City of St. Paul and its neighboring cities, including Minneapolis and others, have prepared responses to such accidents. These responses are not effectively coordinated with the state. We would ask that the job responsibilities of this planner would include acting as a liaison for St. Paul to the State Emergency Operations Center during metro area emergencies, and this person will be responsible for emergency response planning to critical state infrastructures within the City of St. Paul. Thanks very much for your time, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Chief, just a couple of questions. Tell us again what activities are you proposing to coordinate, and also, that's the question for now. What activities, again, describe those?
Certainly. Thank you, Representative. The activities include coordinated planning for mass evacuation, for pandemic flu, for the results of hazardous materials or catastrophic event within the City of St. Paul as they affect the state of Minnesota and the infrastructures that are here within the capital.
Mr. Chairman, Chief, is any of that being done right now?
We have an emergency preparedness coordinator whose also job includes communications for the St. Paul Fire Department. So he's about 75% of his work is devoted to emergency management.
Oh, Mr. Chairman. Chief, then what I'm hearing then is this bill simply asking the state to reimburse St. Paul for an employee who's already doing these jobs?
Chief Pleasance.
Thank you. No, Representative Smith, this will be supplementing that position and in addition to that position already in place.
Representative Smith.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Then one more question. So if you don't get this bill passed, if you don't get the money, then you're not going to do the planning for evacuation or spills? You won't be able to do it?
Chief Pleasant.
Thank you. We will, due to the best of our ability, we will continue to try to continue with planning as best as we can. The problem now is a lot of mandates coming down from the federal government where our emergency planner is spending nearly half of his time devoted to grant writing and justification for grant writing for federal programs rather than doing the hardcore emergency planning that we need to do for the City of St. Paul and for the state infrastructure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We do have a quorum present now, so Representative Lesh will move House File 1761. Representative Lesh is moving the 0331 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment prevails. Now we have the bill in front of us. Are there any other questions of the testifier or Representative Lesh? Chief Pleasance, I guess two questions. Homeland Security funds, have you checked with the Department of Public Safety to see if there's funding available to do this? And also, it looks like this is ongoing funding to your base budget. So that's the first question. And then I understood from the Does any of this have to do with the Republican National Convention coming to St. Paul, or is that totally a separate issue?
Last question first. That's a totally separate issue. Obviously, this work that this planner does would benefit the preparations for that the Republican National Convention, but this is is ongoing and has to do with all hazard approach rather than just a one-time event. As far as funding for positions, there is no funding source through the state or federal government for positions. We've been able to get grant money through the federal government for things. For example, last year we got close to $4 million. Much of it was for a camera system for downtown through Port Security Act. We had some money that we obtained for radios and interoperable communications and some other trainings for the state bomb squad and collapse rescue were the highlights of those. None for positions, though, for planning.
Chief, then the crux of the issue here is you're saying that because there are so many state buildings in the city of St. Paul that the capital city should have a full-time individual to deal with emergency preparedness funded by the state is basically the... Is that one of...
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, any other questions? Then Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Chief, have you gone to the St. Paul City Council with this request, and what has been their action?
Chief Pleasance.
Thank you. Our budget request is not included at this time. Is it not included in a request for additional person for this, at this time?
Mr. Chairman, so then the answer is yeah. The answer is you haven't asked the city yet to do this.
We're doing it.
Chief Pleasance.
Thank you. We're doing an ongoing study of what our emergency management needs are right now. We have a consultant that's looking at the fire department and looking at emergency management. We know that we don't fund emergency management, nor is it supported in the manner that it is in a lot of places around the country. I had a recent conversation with Nashville, which is another state capital that has 45 persons involved in emergency management, and about 15 or 16 of them are funded by the state for the city of Nashville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any closing comments, Representative Lane?
Just, Mr. Chair, in partial response to Representative Smith's question, that was a response that I got, and I did speak with several city council members who, and the council did approve this as a legislative request, but they said, you know, with 14,000 employees, other like capital cities in the United States have a similar coordinator or have state help with emergency preparedness, considering the sheer number of state employees that are in St. Paul. Ironically, which I would also point out, those facilities which do not pay property taxes to the city because they're state buildings, we lose that tax base. So I would simply say in closing, Mr. Chair, that I got a letter back from Norm Coleman the other day at my house, and I think it must have been a response to something I signed on to some resolution, like we all do, and then send it off into the feds and say, hey, please support this initiative. And there's the P.S. that he has at the end of all his letters. It says, you know, I apologize if this letter got to you late, but because of security measures around the Capitol, our mail is backed up. Now, as you can see in a position like that where you have a city like Washington, D.C., which has an extraordinary amount of security measures that they have to consider because of the sheer number of capital employees, like the outbreak that occurred and sent it off the building several years ago. I think it illustrates the point that we could use a coordinator for that here as well. Even though we are a state government, we have those similar types of needs, albeit on a different scale. So.
Okay. Chief Pleasance, thank you for your testimony. Representative Lesh, there's no more questions. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is Representative Johnson, House File 1496.
Thank you. Johnson for 1890.
Representative Olin, we need you to move the minutes of March 13th. I understand there's a correction on
that. Yes, I'll move the minutes of March 13th as correct.
What was the correction? Very good. Who caught that?
That would be Mr. Bearden handed it to me as I walked in. I normally read the minutes very, very carefully, Mr. Chair. This morning it was read before I even walked in, so thank you to Mr. Bearden.
Except the correction is at the bottom of page 2. Chair Paymar moved House File 693. It should say, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Coles. Thank you, Representative Olin. All those in favor of the corrected minutes from what date was that again? March 13th, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Fails. Thank you. Okay, Representative Johnson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1496 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Johnson, do you want to describe your bill for us?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This bill is seeking one-time money, and I want to emphasize that it's seeking one-time money for a 12-month program designed to examine and address disproportionate minority contact and juvenile detention alternatives in the juvenile justice system in Ramsey County. So it's one-time money seeking for this 12-month pilot program. And as most of you know, I've been involved in juvenile adult probation for well over 30 years now. And a couple of things I've learned. One is that evidence-based practices based on good data, good data is really the best way to direct intervention efforts. And a second thing I've learned working with adults and young people in probation is that the best predictor of whether I'm going to see someone as an adult in the criminal justice system is whether they've been involved as a juvenile in the criminal justice system. And this particular pilot program is directed towards both these dynamics. And I have two people here to talk about it, Mr. Strong from the St. Paul Police Department, and I'm going to turn it over right now to Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Chair Paymar. I'm Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner for District 4 in St. Paul. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk with all of you about this very important bill that is before you, House File 1496. Ramsey County, together with a number of partners, has been working in a process with the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the Hayward F. Burns Foundation, working on juvenile detention alternatives initiatives. Also, together with me today, in addition to Commander Paul Strong, I have Senior Commander Tim Lynch from the St. Paul Police Department and Attorney, County Attorney Kate Rickman, who is the head of our juvenile division in Ramsey County. Also here, Frank Hosh from our Ramsey County Corrections Juvenile Division and Chris Crutchfield. So we want to share a little bit of information and then answer questions that you may have. Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, or JDAI for short, intends to improve public safety and long-term outcomes for young people by diverting those young people from secure detention. These are youth who have committed a law violation, some including technical and status violations, but who pose low risk of reoffense. Diverting them into some sort of community-based alternative before they are further involved with our juvenile justice system can, in fact, help them to achieve better long-term outcomes. The national research shows us that merely the act, as our Representative Johnson has stated, of being involved in juvenile detention is a significant predictor of their long-term involvement with the criminal justice system, and also of more negative future outcomes, in particular school failure, in child protection, possible incarceration as adults. And this is not least because so many low-risk offenders are being held in secure detention with more serious offenders. This will help us to eliminate also the disproportionate minority confinement that we here locally, as well as nationally, are experiencing in juvenile detention, and to focus our detention dollars on those who must be securely detained because of the offenses they have committed and the risk that they pose to public safety. Overall, we intend to save public dollars by utilizing Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. It is a broad-based, long-term solution that will help us to reform our systems and to build community capacity, and has the potential to drastically and effectively transform our juvenile detention system over the long term. I want you to know that as the incidences of juvenile crime have decreased over the last decade, we have found here locally and also nationally that juveniles detained securely, the number of juveniles detained securely has increased. And you will see on the information that you have the change from 94 to 2004 here in Ramsey County, with our average daily admissions increasing 58% and our average daily population increasing 87%. In 2004, admissions to the JDC, however, for violent crimes, which would include persons, drugs, weapons, and sex, constituted only 22% of our admissions. And violations for probation, parole, contempt of court, warrants, and status violations constituted 46% of our admissions. We have a serious problem in Ramsey County, as well as other counties in Minnesota and throughout the nation, with disproportionate minority confinement and contact with youth of color, who are only 41% in Ramsey County, as 71% of our juvenile detention, secure detention population. This is true at every significant step in the juvenile justice process, and those youth become more deeply involved in the system and are less likely to be offered pretrial diversions. Again, Ramsey County has been working with Annie Casey and with an organization called the Hayward Burns Institution. We have assembled a group of broad representatives from throughout systems, including our county corrections department, the city, the police, the county attorney, our public defender, the sheriff, police chiefs, St. Paul Public Schools, and others, including community stakeholders, who have been involved with us consistently, and there is large consensus that we need change within our juvenile justice system. We have a steering committee and subcommittees connected to our JDAI process of stakeholders, and these committees are charged with conducting the work, the challenging task of collecting data across systems, identifying and engaging the existing and needed alternatives for youth who are at low risk of reoffense but who may have high need, and to construct an assessment tool that will help us to actually make decisions as to the needs of those youth and alternatives that will assist them. We are working together to establish our consensus mission and some guiding principles for our work. House File 1496 will help us with the work that has already been accomplished, I should say, utilizing part-time staff and people who are focusing with us as volunteers. The work is not sustainable in that manner, we understand, and we need to keep pace with our growing institutional insistence and determination for change. This pilot project will help us by supporting a 12-month process to accomplish three goals. The first is to gather and to analyze data across systems. JDAI must be data-driven and evidence-based. The data has been collected in systems, but there is no consistent representation of such, and we want to establish a consistent system-wide collection process. We will also be creating and testing and validating a screening instrument that will be objective and actuarial and assist us to determine which youth belong in detention and which can do better in other alternatives. And we will be conducting a gap analysis to help us understand the services that exist today and the services that are needed to meet the needs of young people who can do better in community alternatives. Again, this is a long-term program. It is a self-sustaining program. It will assist us to ensure that youth are able to exist in community community-based alternatives, and the trajectory of their lives can be changed by ensuring that they are doing better in such a way. We believe that we will be able to assist our state because, again, communities across the state are experiencing the same dilemma that we are. We have learned from other states, for example, New Mexico, that JDAI does work. And we will be able to show here in Minnesota how it can work in our counties. We will be diverting youth from the juvenile justice system and avoiding their long-term involvement. I'd like to turn this over now to Commander Strong and ask that he share with you the police department perspective and then to Kate Rickman from our county attorney.
Commander Strong, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Paul Strong. I'm a 19-year veteran with the St. Paul Police Department and the previous commander of the St. Paul Police Juvenile Unit. This is my second tour in juvenile as a ranking officer in the city of St. Paul. I first started in investigations when I was first promoted back in 95 and was able to head the unit last year with my involvement with juveniles from the SRO School Resource Officer Program. And what we have found within the department and within the other three major departments involved as corrections in the county is that we all collect great information. St. Paul Police can gather data on the arrests and the information that comes in through our department. The county gathers their information on the court process, and corrections can gather information on those who are incarcerated. But what we lack is that communication loop between the three organizations in order for us to get the accurate data that we need in order for us to be driven, data-driven, and evidence-driven in solving disproportionate minority confinement and contact. This program is not a program that is just going to slap kids on the wrist and let them go without having some sort of consequences for their actions. What we need is to better utilize the services that we have through the system. And this is going to incorporate system change amongst through the county and the other three counties involved. But it's going to give the kids the most appropriate, the best practice possible to deal with the issues at hand. And many of these issues we deal with are mental illness, status offenses, family crisis programs, and first-time offender programs that probably don't need to be in JDC at this point, that we could probably find another alternative for them to still hold them accountable for their actions and have some discussion on their behavior and some treatment or assessment based on their behavior out in the streets. But in order for us to do that, we need that communication loop between the three organizations in order for us to accurately identify and pinpoint the problem and where the problems are for us to benefit the children of St. Paul, Ramsey County.
Thank you, Commander. Is there anyone else? Good morning, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Kate Richtman, and I'm an attorney in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and I head the Juvenile Prosecution Division of that office. I'm here to speak on behalf of adopting House File 1496. A couple of things. First of all, one of the things that the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative is designed to do is it's designed to be systems change. And it really is designed to create alternatives to detention. But what we cannot do right now in Ramsey County or in the other two counties, Dakota and Hennepin, that are embarking on this initiative, is really figure out what those alternatives should be at this point. And in order to protect public safety, both in the short term, meaning what to do with the child when they are picked up and where to place them and what to do with the child in the long run in terms of protecting public safety and ensuring that they receive the immediate consequence and the long-term services that they need is to figure out where our gaps in services are and to distinguish between the high-need, low-risk juvenile and the high-need and high-risk juvenile is something which we really cannot do based on the data that we have right now. And what we need to do is conduct a gap analysis between the services required and the response that's appropriate. And why is this something that this legislative body should be interested in is, to me, very simple. What we are going to be learning is something that we know we can translate to other counties in Minnesota. I think especially this is a tri-county initiative, this juvenile detention alternative initiative. Hennepin, Ramsey, and Dakota counties are embarking on this initiative, both collectively in terms of some combined initiatives, but also creating our own individual initiative within the county of what makes sense to our system. What makes sense in Ramsey County is not going to make sense necessarily in Hennepin County. But the lessons that we learn in Ramsey County, the lessons that we learn in Dakota County, and the lessons that are learned in Hennepin County can be translated to the rest of the state. And my experience over the past 20 years is that Ramsey County is very similar to many other counties in the state. We have a lot of shared experiences, perhaps more so than our large neighbor to the west of us in Hennepin County. And we know that from our own experience of going to other sites for the juvenile detention alternative. For example, we've gone to Illinois, we've gone to Oregon, and we studied other states, that what we learn here, we need to bring home. What we learn there, excuse me, we need to bring home and analyze that experience as how it will change what we do internally in terms of our practices, but also then what our lessons learned, how can we share that information and translate it to other counties and their experience.
Thank you, Ms. Richtman. What was the name again, Rick?
Richtman.
Richtman, I did have that. Thank you for your testimony. What, Commissioner or Representative Johnson, what's the money actually going to be used for? It seems we don't have a budget. Is this going to hire individuals in the county to look at what possible alternatives there would be to juvenile detention? Just give us a snapshot of how the money is going to be used and also how much money you have from the Casey Foundation and the other foundation that you identify.
Okay. We do have a budget and we can provide that for you. But very briefly, we will be bringing on board from part-time to full-time a coordinator for the initiative to coordinate the various activities and across systems. We will be designing a risk assessment tool and validating that tool. We'll be conducting a gap analysis across systems to determine what needs exist. We'll be supporting data collection between the departments and, making a consistent process across. We do want to make certain that we have a clear evaluation of the process after the end of the 12 months so that it can help us to ensure the design of alternatives that are needed moving forth. And there's some assistance for capacity building and change management within the police department and schools, who are the major entry points, of course, to our detention system.
We have a budget that's being passed out here. Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chairman, members, I got a number of questions, but the first of all, I guess I was wondering if this is the best agency to do a study on. The paperwork seems to jump back and forth between juvenile or juvenile of color. There's carte blanche methods about juvenile detention, and then there talks about juvenile detention of people of color, and you talked about actual physical things you do in programs, and then you talked about a study. And so I'm wondering why your study will be any different than the national studies or other state studies that have been done on everything from education to do with color and opportunities to incarceration, to how many people are detained or prosecuted and things. And how will your study be different and find different things out? And then are you approaching the whole juvenile aspect or just juveniles of color? That was the first question, I guess, a basic one.
Okay. Carter.
Thank you. I'd just like to make certain I understand the question. First, it was how this study here will be different than what we've been able to observe across the nation. And then secondly, are we focusing on only juveniles of color or all juveniles within our detention system? First of all, we do have information from sites nationally who have been able to reduce their juvenile detention population and who have been able to address the issue of disproportionate minority contact for juveniles of color. We know anecdotally and from their data what is potentially possible here in Ramsey County and across the state of Minnesota. But we definitely need to know who our detention population is. You know, we need to validate what appears to be a national circumstance and hone that down to what is actually existing in Ramsey County. So we have to mine the data and pull that information together so that we know whether, for example, we have a huge failure to appeal rate, as others do, and would be able to, by addressing those juveniles, dramatically reduce our population. We don't know that. We can certainly suspect it from what we see across the nation. And, you know, that's to address your question as to what we might discover differently. It may not be different. Nuances may be, however, similar and also different here in Ramsey County. But we have to base what we are doing on data and evidence so that we know we're proceeding properly. And secondly, it has been observed across the nation that everyone has a disproportionate minority confinement. Here in Ramsey County, we believe that as well. However, the initiative Juvenile Detention Alternatives addresses all juveniles who are in detention. And by focusing on those who are low risk and can do better in other alternatives, and focusing our detention, secure detention resources on those who need to be securely confined, we know that we will also be addressing the numbers of juveniles and very possibly reducing the number of juveniles of color. However, here in Ramsey County, our focus is also to address disproportionate minority confinement by specifically looking at the incidences of juveniles of color and identifying what particular circumstances may exist to assist us to not only reduce the number of juveniles, but also to address that disproportionate minority contact and confinement issue.
Representative Cornish.
The only other thing, just a comment, Mr. Chairman, maybe you've recognized or seen this too, but this is about the third program where we said let's start it out in St. Paul and then go out state with it. And like the other one that we were talking about the other day, I really think it needs a statewide approach because mm-hmm. we have different minority populations. In Kuching County, where I used to work, would be the Indian population, and Sudanese, Somalian, and Mankato, and here, and it seems like a statewide application, somehow coordinated, would be best rather than starting in one area and then trying to take it out after that. But that's just a comment.
Commissioner, quick response.
Chair Paymar, Representative Cornish, I would agree with you totally. And that is why working with the Department of Public Safety, we have been able to place a Association of Minnesota Counties coordinator in the AMC office so that lessons learned here are being communicated to other areas and the relationship between this project and the state is being drawn.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I'm a bit confused. This document talks about proven successes and 10 years in operation, but this is a national thing?
That
this
is correct.
This isn't St. Paul?
That is correct.
Okay. And has Ramsey County been doing this for 10 years, or for have they just started, or what's I that's the part I don't quite get, and then I have two more questions.
Commissioner Carter.
We are in the process of conducting a three-year project with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. This is the beginning of our second year of that work.
Representative Murphy.
And then could you tell me how much of the appropriation that you're asking for, $222,000, how much is being of that appropriation will go for this risk assessment instrument, how much will go to the gap analysis, and how much will go to the
Representative Murphy.
Is it the AMC coordinator?
Would someone provide that? We have a budget breaking that down, Representative Murphy. I don't, maybe you didn't get it.
It maybe has not circulated yet. I can answer your question. The risk assessment instrument will be utilizing $20,000 of the request. Our gap analysis is $20,000. Support for data collection across departments is $50,000. The evaluation is $35,000. And I'm sorry, I'm going so quickly. I know that you're getting that breakdown, so you won't have to write it. And the coordinator that is at AMC is not a part of our budget. Again, we're working with the Public Safety Department, which has been able to facilitate that.
Representative Murphy.
Okay, and then what happens to the coordinator? This is a one-time appropriation that you're asking for. What happens to the coordinator after this?
Commissioner Carter.
Thank you. What we know is that we have to jumpstart this process by focusing the attention of our coordinator on a full-time basis. We are anticipating that this will be a long-term change process for us. And we know that although we need additional resources today so that we can maintain the system that we're operating while we're building the additional focus on alternatives, that our objective is long-term system change. So we will be reallocating resources over time to address this area.
Representative Murphy.
And the police change management effort is just going to be used for training the police for this program.
Commissioner Carter.
Correct. We will be working to address together systematically the changes that all systems need to make and to train the police and the schools to build capacity for making those changes. And Commander Strong may want to address that as well.
Commander Strong.
Part of the process of what we need to accomplish is to have police officer buy-in to the program and understanding of the problem that we have currently in the juvenile justice system. When we look at the data, even in St. Paul, as we are probably the biggest contributor to the juvenile justice system in Ramsey County, we are looking at the disproportionate minority confinement and contact that we have in the city. We need to educate the officers to identify and to be aware, cognizant of the issue that's at hand. And part of this training dollars is going to be able to help us through our in-service training program, getting the proper people in there to discuss the issue with the police department and with the officers involved so that we can all together work on this systemic change that we're trying to incorporate with this program.
Representative Murphy.
Okay, and this is it. But what about this program have you done that you've convinced Hennepin and Dakota that this is such a good thing that they're already in?
Commissioner.
The Annie E. Casey Foundation is a nationwide foundation that focuses on the needs of young children at risk. The Annie E. Casey Foundation is working with Ramsey, Hennepin, and Dakota, providing technical support for us to visit, to understand what has happened across the nation and the successes that have occurred in their model sites, and to then apply our work here.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to take Representative Eastland and then Representative Cornish, and then we probably should move on. We have two more bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions that I'm not quite clear about. This is one-time funding, I think the program currently is set up for a 3 or 4 year. You're funded through Annie Casey for about a three-year cycle. Is this an ongoing program after the 3 years? Is this process continued to be funded? Is there an ongoing obligation to this process after the initial 3 years?
Commissioner Carter.
Thank you, Representative Eastland. Again, this is a change process. And so the one-time dollars that we're asking for today will allow us to sustain the work of change across multiple organizations and to identify the systems change that needs to occur on an ongoing basis. So the work will be to reallocate resources over time to address this area. It will not be an ongoing program. It will be the way that we do business in the future.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the national, at your national model. Evidently, they're in Illinois. There's Cook County, Illinois. It says here the net savings to the county from successful detention reform, therefore, is almost $250 million. I guess it's hard for me to understand why there is a need to infuse money into a program that is going to have the kind of astronomical savings that we're claiming that it's going to have after a very short period of time. That's kind of one of my concerns. That's not really a question. It's just an observation. The second issue is there's nothing in the request, which concerns me a little bit, that really clarifies what I've been hearing here, that this is going to be something that's going to benefit the state. It would be nice if there was some kind of a report or some kind of a some kind of an obligation to move this process beyond just St. Paul. I think that would be just kind of an interesting. So those are just kind of two thoughts or concerns that I have about the bill. Although I support the concept, I think it's clearly the direction we need to be going. And I appreciate the N.E. Kasich Foundation is part of the initiative because they're doing a lot of great work. So, I mean, I think those are just some concerns that I've got.
Commissioner Carter.
I don't want to spend the rest of your day, but I do just want to point out that working together with the Public Safety Department, the coordinator is at the Association of Minnesota Counties for exactly that reason. And we've been encouraged to pursue this relationship with Annie Casey so that this can be brought to our state. And, you know, we certainly are committed to ensuring that we utilize the resources from the National Association of Counties, who is also working in a focused relationship with Annie Casey. And those resources will come out to our state, and we intend through the Association of Minnesota Counties to ensure that other counties are trained and being brought on board. That is our commitment to you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Carter, Commander Strong, County Attorney Rickman, and Representative Johnson, do you have any closing comments on your bill?
No, just thank you for your attention and willingness to hear the bill. It is a good bill, and appreciate your support.
Okay, Representative Johnson, thank you. We'll lay House File 1496 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. And the next bill up is Representative Hillstrom, House File 1864. While Representative Hillstrom is going up to present her bill, I just wanted to talk about Representative Hillstrom's bill yesterday on the 911 fee or tax or whatever it is for armor, and whether the bill needs to be referred to taxes. In talking to Sherilyn Chesky, she is going to hear all of the omnibus bills in her committee. So therefore, it will take a route to taxes at some point, unless anyone has any. I think Representative Coles also talked to her about that.
It's going to go to taxes.
Okay,
Mr. Chair. Yes. So, am I understanding this right? So, it would go if it's included in the omnibus bill. Going with the omnibus bill is how it would get the taxes.
Yeah.
It's not going to go there separately.
Representative Eastland, that's the way she wants to hear the.
Oh, okay.
So, the tax or the fee will be reviewed by the tax committee. Representative Hillstrom, welcome. You want to introduce your bill?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1864 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill would appropriate $750,000 in fiscal year 08 and $750,000 in fiscal year 09 via grants to supervised parenting time service providers. Many of you know that this used to be something that was funded, and then there were some changes in the budget. Mr. Carter is going to help me, I think, with this. Apparently, $3 of the marriage license fee used to go to this, and there was some problem with some language. The money was collected, and then they couldn't allocate them. And then So that has kind of stopped, and now parenting time centers are in crisis. We've had two close already, and there was a survey that was done of all the current parenting time centers, and they all replied that, yes, they're having financial difficulties now. Many of them are still struggling to keep their doors open. I'm handing out some papers. That one is a map of where all the parenting time centers are. One is a story of someone who felt that it was a benefit. And then there is a answers to commonly asked questions about supervised parenting time and other visitation services that kind of goes through when people use this and how they use it. And then the last piece of paper is kind of a chart of when some of the sites are open and how much each parent pays to use them. Mr. Chair, I became very aware of supervised parenting centers when I was going through the court case for the new young man that lives in my home. I begged the court for supervised visitation of this young man. It was not, in fact, ordered. It was not something that we were able to do. And in the end, there was a crisis situation that resulted, and now Dylan's biological father can have no contact of any kind. With Dylan. I think that had parenting time been supervised, that we may have resulted in keeping that contact intact. And so I would encourage members' consideration of this bill.
Representative Hillstrom, the counties typically order parents to these visitation centers, if I'm not I don't know if you know the answer to this, but do all the counties then pay for a portion of it, since these are essentially nonprofits that are doing work on behalf of the county? Are they paying for? Do you have an analysis county by county, or is there an expectation about how much they should be paying for this?
I don't have one, but I certainly can get that for you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Hillstrom, the Supervised Visitation Network, what is that, and who's comprised of that network?
I think I left that handout over on my table. Oh, no, right here. Mr. Chair, these are the Supervised Visitation Network are just people who provide this service. They're allowed to join into this network, and they then provide service to each other.
So the standards and guidelines are promulgated by the people who do the work?
Mr. Chair, they actually were the ones that came over the past to actually get in statute rules about how these were supposed to operate. That has been happening over time. In 2004, there was some legislation to actually get in law what kinds of standards that these supervised visitation centers should operate under. It also had a way of funding them with a fee, and it was clear to them that that was not going to happen. And so those efforts were kind of abandoned, and this was the attempt this time.
Final question I have is this. So how will the so then each one of these programs then could apply to DPS then for a grant?
$750,000. Yes, Mr. Chair. In this bill, it says that the commissioner shall establish grant evaluation and award criteria for the program. So, therefore, we would be able to make certain that we had an appropriate one. One of the things that happened in the supervised visitation center that was in my district in particular, there were financial difficulties, which then resulted in people not following best practices. And then it ended up being not a safe situation, and the center was closed. And so we want to make sure that it isn't funding that is creating these negative situations. We want to make certain that they have the ability to be safe places.
Before Representative Eastland, I understand this. So who then evaluates the centers to ensure that they are safe for the children who are being supervised? These are volatile situations where you have potentially a domestic violence offender and who's dropping their child off. And who's that? Is someone monitoring these centers, or is that done through DPS or OJP? Or Can you provide that information at some point?
I can provide that for you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions. One of them was similar to what you just asked. I was just reading on the on this this sheet, kind of on page two there in the top, the first one, what kind of procedures are in place to protect the safety of parents and children using the safety center. It says each provider has their own standards for security. I guess that I don't know if that's a fact or if somebody's just reporting that anecdotally. I'm not sure. But it sounds like there's kind of a wide open set of standards for how these things would function. So I guess that's one of my questions is we want to ensure safety, and so to establish some kind of best practices. Should we be just opening up more without that, or should we be proceeding down that road as well? The second question that I have is just on the map. It looks like there's some kind of real geographic disparities for where these things even exist, and I'm wondering if some of these funds shouldn't be directed to kind of accomplish more of a geographic balance, so that some areas of the state where you might have to drive a couple hundred miles to find one, and there's other areas of the state where you could have, if you were located, you could have three or four within 30 or 40 miles probably. So I guess that's kind of the question. I have two issues that I would have here. I guess maybe you want to talk about those.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, rural Minnesota is one of the places that they're having the most trouble, but if there isn't financial resources, even those that do start up have not successfully been able to continue. Again, we used to have one in my area as well. It has since closed. Now the closest one is in South Minneapolis, even for us. So even living in a metropolitan area, it's not convenient. It's not on the bus line. It's not necessarily easily accessible from my area. So I agree, and I think that hopefully these financial resources would enable them to kind of spread out as well.
Representative Murphy, then Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom, thank you for bringing this before us, and thank you for your questions, Mr. Chair, because they're right on. You can imagine my astonishment last summer when I heard of someone that had to have supervised visitation, and what was picked is the Holiday gas station, and the cashier was a supervisor. I thought that was just nuts. And this happened for several weeks until the cashier finally said, hey, this isn't right. And they did indeed, just like Representative Eastland said, just drop the kid, and then the kids go in. And what does the 18-year-old Holiday cashier know about the whole thing? It was just astonishing to me that someone in responsibility would think that this was okay.
Anything else, Representative Murphy? Representative Haas.
We were using the new Walmart store in Stearns County. No, just joking. The Stearns County, where as a commissioner, we had contracts out, and those contracts, you know, people would submit those, and I believe the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Club were two of the contacts that we have. And they seem to work really well. Are these specifically centers that's what they're going to do? They must be doing something else because there's not enough dollars just to do supervised visits. I remember the contract in St. Cloud was about $65,000 for the year, and nobody's going to survive on that and have a center and pay the costs. How does that work? Could you educate me?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, many of them do other things. For example, in Alexandria, it's the Listening Ear Crisis Center. In Breckenridge, it's the Rape and Abuse Center. Detroit Lakes, it's the Lakes Crisis Center. Brainerd, a Mid-Minnesota Women's Center. There's a YMCA on here. There's a Domestic Violence Center, a Family Service Center, Chrysalis, a church group. So there are many other things that are going on as well. Mostly it is in addition to this.
Do you mind if I get educated here a little bit?
Representative Pazio, we do have one more bill.
Who orders this then? Who makes the determination of who's going to do that? Does the county still make that determination of who they're going to use and this establishes a criteria?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mostly it is court-ordered, and the courts can order whoever the parties are to be. If a supervised visitation center is available, the court can order that. They can order, you know, a grandparent or whatever. But if these centers are available for people who don't have, you know, the family contact or someone else who could be a third-party person to supervise, this is a great alternative.
Well, thank you very much. That's fine.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom, it's a good bill. I'm very aware of these programs. I really think they're such a good thing for kids, because when you have that kind of animosity between two parents and the courts involved, and you have a safe place where a child can be dropped off, and it's coordinated, so if the father or the mother drops the child off, they do it in a way where there's no contact with the parents. The child has an opportunity to be in a nice environment. It's the supervised while the parent is there, and it's just an excellent program. We should have these all through the state, but it's costly. So thank you for bringing the bill. We'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The final bill is Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 1454 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please present your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm very excited about this bill. This bill emanated from a discussion, actually a big meeting of the North Metro mayors and many of the city council members. And the main topic of conversation during that particular meeting was the issue of crime and crime prevention. There were a lot of solutions discussed, and it became very apparent that this is a multifaceted piece that we need to address. It's not just more policemen, it's just not more incarceration, and certainly involves families, but we also know that it involves finding things for students to be involved in after school hours. And this particular bill addresses perhaps in just in one particular situation a center that is working in Brooklyn Park, and we think deserves some attention. It's been, you'll hear details about it, how long it's been operating and what kinds of students it serves and what kinds of things they do at the center. But I might add that this is what we need, in my opinion, as a part of the crime prevention in some areas that I think are pretty critical. Brooklyn Park is an issue that, or an area that I think needs to be addressed in terms of finding solutions. And so with that, I'd like to introduce several of the speakers. We have Elise Farnsworth, Lasandra Higgins, Renee Bowman, who's the mayor of Crystal, and Brad Brown, who's the Mosaic board chair. And I might add also on the school district, the board of directors. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Elise.
Representative Peters, just for the people who are testifying, if you can keep your comments to a couple of minutes, please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you for hearing us today, and we will keep it brief. My name is Elise Farnsworth, and I'm the executive director of the Friends of the Mosaic Youth Center. The Mosaic is a nonprofit organization which serves middle and high school students in the northwest suburbs of Hennepin County. Since September, we've served over 400 youth and their families. And at the Mosaic, we provide an opportunity for students to be involved in safe, productive, healthy activities that include academic support, career exploration, and post-secondary planning, as well as a lot of the fun stuff, the social recreational activities that Lasandra will tell you a little bit more about, but things like hip-hop dance and basketball and creative arts. Our mission is to help all youth build upon their own educational, recreational, social, creative, and leadership abilities for the benefit of the Northwest suburbs and the state of Minnesota now and in the future. Our goals are to help reduce juvenile crime, to improve adolescent health, to improve academic success and to reduce the achievement gap, and finally to help develop youth leaders and improve youth civic engagement. During the after-school hours, youth can truly choose one of two paths. They can either choose healthy, safe, fun, productive ways to use their time, like at the Mosaic, or they can get involved in risky behaviors, including juvenile crime. At the Mosaic, we strive to provide an opportunity for youth to choose those healthy activities. We think that we're successful at reducing crime and risk behaviors and increasing those healthy behaviors for three primary reasons. First, we're strengthened by our partnerships with a number of organizations, including our core partners, the Robbinsdale Area Redesign Family Service Collaborative, the Annex Teen Clinic, Family and Children's Service, and Fairview Recovery Services, because we look at youth as a whole person and serve those needs. In addition to those core partners, we work alongside many nonprofits in our community, our local schools, and seven local police departments. And our partnership with the police departments, I think, is a great example of how we're reducing juvenile crime and increasing those healthy youth behaviors. Officers from the seven police departments are involved with our middle school students and serve as mentors during our middle school after-school program. They work with the students on academics and also participate with them on social recreational activities. Second, relationships are key to all of our work. The adults who are at the Mosaic really care about the students and are involved with the students in terms of helping them set goals and reach those goals for the future. We know that if youth have healthy, productive goals for their future, they're more likely to be involved in the healthy behaviors and less likely to get involved in the risky behaviors like juvenile crime. And finally, our programs are for youth, by youth, and what I mean by that is that the youth truly are involved in every step of the process. They become leaders, they become engaged, they help us plan the programs, evaluate the programs, and run the programs. And I think when youth are engaged in their community and are serving in leadership roles, they're much less likely, again, to get involved in the risky behaviors like juvenile crime. So I would urge you to choose the youth and to support the after-school time programs as a crime prevention measure, because truly after-school time can either be a prime time for juvenile crime or a wonderful time for youth to be involved in enrichment behaviors. So I will turn it over to Lysandra, and of course we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
My name is Lysandra Higgins, and I am an active member of the Mosaic Youth Center. There we interact with the adults very well. They help us with our academic and our social, and they also help us stay out the streets. And we also work with them like side by side with the Advisory Youth Council, which I'm part of. When I come there, I do hip hop. I participate in most of the activities there, and I just have fun while I'm there. The Mosaic Youth Center has helped me it made me successful in my academics. It kept me off the streets. It made me interact with adults more, and it's just a really nice place to be.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on behalf of the bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for hearing our testimony. My name is Renee Bowman, and I am the Mayor of the City of Crystal, Minnesota. Just a couple of points from our perspective. I'm very lucky to live in a community that has had a long-held, long-lasting relationship with youth in our community, as evidenced by our recent skate park, our upgraded swimming pool, And the truancy officer that we have that works on a daily basis, dedicated full-time to keeping kids in school. Added to that, our police chief has been very involved with the Mosaic and does the mentoring program. I think the most important thing that I would like to get across today is that the Mosaic Youth Center is not a dream. It is a 10-year-old organization in our community that has been providing services to youth and helping to keep kids off the streets. One of the, we got our crime figures in my city recently, and crime in the city of Crystal, although we're a rather small, sleepy community of single-family homes, has decreased over the last 3 years. And perhaps I can't prove that the Mosaic Youth Center has had an impact on it. I think the 30-year history of my city of making sure that youth are safe and happy and healthy within the community is paying off. And most important that I see, again, is it's part of a national movement. I was just recently in Washington, D.C. at a National League of Cities conference where youth were very well represented, and cities across the nation are looking at proactive ways to help keep kids healthy and grow them into positive adulthood. And one of the things that we know about our youth centers is what they provide is access. In an aggregate way, you can take smaller amounts of resources and greater number of kids can benefit from these things. They have access to learning. They have access to medical services. They have access to healthy relationships. They have access to recreation in a drug-free, alcohol-free, safe environment. That access as a to a safe place helps children build positive futures, because access to these services provides hope, and hope helps our children in my community build towards the future. The money that we're coming here to ask you for today is part of the investment part that we do in our communities, and we are hoping that you will help us invest in the children in our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Brad Brown. I'm the chair of the 501c3 we call Friends of Mosaic. I'm also a member of the Robbinsdale School Board. I've been involved with this project since 1997. As Mayor Bowman just said, we've been expanding and growing the program, but it's been out there operating and delivering service to youth for over a decade now. The way this project came about, the way this all happened was back in 1997, there was an organization that sponsored sort of a focus group of teens and talking about what's it like to be a teen in 1997, what's going on in your life. And they talked about a lot of things, but one of the things that came out of that was we don't have a place to hang. We go to the malls and we get run out. There's a lot of places we can get into trouble, but not many places we can get together and just get together. For any of you who have raised a teen or have been a teen, and I presume that's all of us here, you know that one of the driving forces in a youth's life is to hang, is to get together with other peers of about your age and just hang out. So we know that teens are going to do that. They're going to do that whether we want them to or not, and they're going to do that in a way that can be healthy and constructive, or they can do that in a way that leads to criminal activity. And we know that both things happen. The Mosaic Youth Center is designed for a place for teens to hang in a safe, sober environment, and in constructive activities that not just keep them out of trouble, but actually add to the value of the community through community service, and also help them advance their studies, do job shadowing, start to think about what a career is after school. So the Mosaic Youth Center is fairly unique in that it is really a wraparound concept. At the core, we have the recreation center, which is the attractant. It's sort of like the anchor store in a mall. It's what gets kids in the door. They can play basketball. They can do the hip-hop. They can do all of you hip-hop? I assume that you all do. We do lessons if you're interested. But there's the fun stuff for the kids can do. But then also there's these wraparound services. So once they're in the door, they can get help with homework. They can get medical attention. There's lots of services available to them. So what I want to emphasize here, and what I want to leave you with, is our teens are going to hang. They're going to get together in the street corner. They're going to get together in places where they can get into trouble, or they're going to get together in places where they can have a constructive relationship with each other, with her community and with other adults. Thank you.
Okay, questions from the committee. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. I mean, the bill is written, obviously, for a grant, so I'm assuming that it's going to the Mosaic Center. That's where it's going. And so my question, I just have a couple of questions. Do you have like one location now? Is that kind of the way
yes,
it's working?
Yes.
Mr. Brown.
It's presently it's a decommissioned Robbinsdale Elementary School, Lincoln Elementary.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
And then approximately how many youth go through the facility on a given year? Now, you said you've been in operation.
I'm going to call Elise back to the table because she really has the operational details.
Ms. Barnesworth.
Thank you. We serve approximately, last year we served over 600 youth. I think it was 633. I don't know the exact figure. Since September, we've had over 400, although last night we had, and I haven't looked at the final figures of everyone who signed in, but somewhere over 75 high school students who came yesterday to participate in the after-school activities. And there were a number of new faces, so that number just popped up last night. So I think we're probably closer to 450 since the beginning of the school year.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then what's your current budget? What's the source of your current budget? How big is it? Where does it come from?
Ms. Barnes,
a little bit.
Our budget since 1997 has been primarily funded. Over 85% of our funding has come from the Robbinsdale Redesigned Family Service Collaborative. We currently are operating between the in-kind contributions from the Family Service Collaborative and our own fundraising that we do from private donations, community fundraisers, and writing grants to foundations at roughly $300,000. Although we continue to serve more and more youth, and we've made a commitment to the community for as long as we can continue to do so, to offer any student who qualifies for free and reduced lunch that their activity fees are automatically waived. We don't want a barrier to participation to be money, and so we're not making a lot from activity fees. And so as we continue to serve more and more youth, and as we continue to serve what we assume will be more and more youth who qualify for free and reduced lunch, we assume that our budget will increase. So for 2008, we're looking at a $350,000 plus budget, and then up from there for 2009.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a two-year grant. It's $300,000 a year for each of the next 2 years. What would this allow you to do that you wouldn't do without this? And the second part to the question is, obviously this grant is written to end in 2 years, and how would you sustain that activity beyond that point? Or are we creating a series of requests here that are going to go beyond this one?
Sorry, I should have said too in the last question that the family service collaboratives are undergoing an anticipated 65% budget reduction, and that obviously is going to trickle down to us, so we anticipate that our funding will be drastically cut from the family service collaboratives. So the board and the staff have been actively pursuing funding, so this funding would allow us to continue serving the youth, to continue operating, and hopefully to expand and, like I said, serve more youth, because we know that there's more youth who in our community could benefit from the services. So it will allow us to make up for, A, that budget reduction, and then, B, to expand our services. And I don't know if, Brad, you want to speak to the
Representative
question.
Representative Eastland. First of all, it would fill the temporary hole from the reduced funding from the redesign. But more importantly, it would allow us to do some capacity building, and by that I mean to develop the ability to go out and do our own fundraising. Right now, we don't have a development officer. We have a board committee that does, but of course, like, you know, these are people who also have day jobs. So that would give us a little breathing room to develop the capacity to become self-sustaining through our own internal fundraising.
And I just really quickly would add that we are aggressively pursuing a number of grants from foundations. So we're also hoping that would help us sustain after the end of 2009.
Representative Haas.
Thank you much, Mr. Chair.
The teens are a very hard group to capture and serve, and I would like to see some documentation or programs that that's exactly what you're doing. I just personally like to do that, especially if it's really getting done. I would like to know how it's getting done. In the Boys and Girls Club programs, they have they're nationally connected to programs that work throughout the nation, such as teens. They probably would be called the Keystone Clubs and stuff. Do you have a national connection, or are you just kind of inventing things, or how does that work in your program?
Ms. Farnsworth.
Thank you. Well, I should say that our programs, I believe, are successful with the youth because they're driven by the youth. We have an advisory council that Lysandra spoke to that's made up of 60% youth and 40% adults. And the youth come with program proposals. They use Robert's Rules of Order, and so they're learning that whole process and come forward with ideas that they believe that their peers will participate in. And the numbers of youth who are coming for those things that they've created have shown us that they're right. They know what they're talking about. And sometimes we bring proposals to them, and they say, no, you're way out in left field. No one's going to come to that. And so we don't go that direction. So that's one thing. We don't have a national affiliation, but we do have a state affiliation. We're part of a group called Youth Community Connections, which used to be the Minnesota Commission on Out-of-School Time. And that's really the clearinghouse in the state for after-school programming, that working with youth.
Representative Paymer, if I may, respond to that also. In some regards, we are the national model. We provide some best practices. If you're familiar with the Search Institute, they published a book based on youth governance and drawn on the experience of the youth governance process in Mosaic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quick question before we lay this bill over. Representative Peterson, have you looked at the as the K-12 committee? Is there any after-school programs that sort of fit this criteria, or is this, I mean, 'cause it's more than just a public safety issue here, or crime reduction for juveniles in your bill. It's broader than that.
Mr. Chair, there are, I think, a couple of bills that have gone through Education Committee. However, they don't have the exact, and they're also very specific, and I think that they're drawn up to fit specific programs also, and they certainly are not like this. And we decided that, although it certainly is an education endeavor, that maybe we need to take a new focus at this and look at this in a different way, because if we are truly looking at the whole issue of reducing crime, and by the way, this is Crystal and Brooklyn Park, I should say, because it's absolutely right on the border. At 62nd, Lincoln School is just right up at the edge, and so it serves both communities. But I think because it's been part of the Robbinsdale School District, it has probably gotten more significant attention from for instance, Mr. Brown and the Mayor Bowman. But anyway, I just think we need to look at this in a different way. We need to think about this differently and be creative. And I know that in education, you know, they may or may not consider. They're certainly dealing with, you know, many other issues which involve the actual schools. And I think, and many times the after-school programs that they're looking at are for younger children or extended, you know, daycare or that kind of thing. And you know, what actually gets funded there will be very interesting, but we just think this is an appropriate place to bring this kind of bill.
Representative Coles.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I guess I share some of your concerns about, you know, how we're going to, if we're going to be able to fit something like this into our budget. I would note, however, that having grown up at 62nd and Xylon on the New Hope Crystal Brooklyn Park border, having attended Meadow Lake Elementary School, which is just a few blocks away from Lincoln, I certainly am pleased to hear what's going on, and I hope that regardless of whether we're able to fund this today, that the community is able to figure out a way to continue these programs. I don't hip-hop. You don't want me to try. It would be a really ugly, ugly scene. I'm pleased to hear that the programs, I mean, the area has changed a whole lot since I grew up there, there's different issues and different kids, and I'm pleased to hear that the community is has been supportive of this, and I hope they'll continue to be, regardless of whether we're able to find the funding to take care of this grant.
Representative Lesh, and then we're going to
thank you, Mr.
Chair. And actually, Representative Coles, I had no idea you grew up at 62nd and Zion. I was like five blocks north of you, right up there off of Boone and 63rd. But, you know, I used to get kicked out of Brookdale every Friday night for shooting those little disc guns, you know, that they'd sell at KB Toy and Hobby. And I really could have used something like this. So, and I think the security personnel at Brookdale really could have used something like this when I was down there. But I think it's a great idea. We used to listen to, you know, Two Live Crew and NWA and Public Enemy too. But, you know, hip-hop wasn't a verb back then. And it is now, I think, another good reason why this would be a great program, because we could all learn a thing or two around the committee. So thanks. I support it.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Peterson. Thank you for bringing the bill. We will lay this bill over for possible. We'll lay House File 1454 for possible inclusion in the omnibus public safety bill. Tomorrow, members, remember that we are meeting in Room 5 at 2:15. This is a joint Public Safety Finance Committee and Public Safety Civil Justice Committee. If there's no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.